Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. It's a cliche, but death is part of life. And while we don't have any say over whether we'll die, we do have control over being prepared legally, financially, and for end-of-life healthcare decisions. Later in the hour, we'll talk with a physician who helps individuals and families discuss and plan for end-of-life. But first, we discuss the legal and financial items to have in order as we age. Joining us is Bob Miscali, an attorney in estate planning and elder law. Welcome, Bob.
Thank you, Mindy. It's great to be here.
And if you have a question about getting your legal or financial house in order as you age, you can join the conversation at 866-999-4626, or you can send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, Bob, death can come at any time. It doesn't just happen to older people. At what age or stage of life do you recommend people have a will in place?
Very early in their lives. In particular, younger couples should be thinking about it, in particular with respect to children and nominating a guardian to possibly take care of them if something should happen to both parents, and consider someone to oversee their finances, a trustee. So, it's a misnomer that younger people shouldn't be thinking about a will. The other thing that people don't realize is that if you don't have a will, what happens is the state will tell you who gets your property. And again, with respect to younger individuals, the statute in Massachusetts is a little quirky in that if you die without a will and have a wife and no children and parents, most people would think that the wife would inherit the entire estate, but that's not the case. There's a split between the spouse and the parents. Now, of course, if they are children, then that's not the situation. So, certainly, anybody that is married and has an estate to think about should think about doing a will.
We'll talk about medical advance directives in a few minutes, yeah. but advance legal directives. Do you recommend people, what do you recommend people have in place regardless of their age?
Sure. So, a general estate plan that we would recommend to a client, and I think most attorneys would do the same, would include a durable power of attorney, which I'll talk a little bit about. Certainly a healthcare proxy which your next guest is going to be speaking about. And then a will and or some kind of a trust may be applicable as well. So the real important thing about a durable power of attorney, and we use the term durable because it means that once you sign it, it will be effective until you pass away. I mean, once you die, power of attorney is gone, obviously. But if you should at some point become incompetent or unable to manage your affairs yourself, the power of attorney will continue to be effective. That's the durability aspect of a power of attorney. And where it's particularly important would be if someone unexpectedly, ends up in a coma or gets into an accident and can't make decisions on their own, either personal, financial, or business. The power of attorney would normally appoint a spouse or a trusted friend, a family member. If you don't have a power of attorney, there's no one authorized to deal with those affairs of yours, and someone would have to go to court to be appointed a guardian or a conservator. So the power of attorney allows the agent whom you appoint to step in and make those decisions for
you. Yeah, it's something to really think about, too, and this can happen at any age. This isn't just older folks we're talking about. And then, you have the family fights. Mm-hmm. No, well, I know that, Johnny wanted this. No, he wanted that. And it can create so many problems.
It certainly can. So, we try to avoid those with estate planning. Yeah. I refer to a quote somewhat misattributed to Lewis Carroll in Alice in Wonderland, but it is, if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. Mm. And our job as estate planning attorneys is to ascertain where it is you want to go and put them on the right path, whether it's using a trust or doing a will or combining them and so forth.
Something we might not be thinking about when we're in our 40s and 50s are the costs associated with health care and assistance as we age, hopefully because, you know, we've been healthy and able. Explain what long-term care insurance is and at what age we should start thinking about that.
Well, certainly, you know, like any insurance product, it's going to be cost is going to be a big consideration. So, I mean, in answer to that question, you should start as early in your career as possible, because the older you get, if you want to get long-term care insurance, obviously, if you're older, your premiums are going to be much higher. You know, long-term care insurance, there are basically two types of long-term care insurance. One is an indemnification policy, in other words, where you submit bills and the insurance company will reimburse you, or there's a direct payment. And it's usually there's usually a period of time that will be, you know, if you need it. Right. And usually the markings for needing it are that you can no longer do certain life activities. Right. So once you meet that measure, whether you're at home or in an assisted facility, long-term care insurance or a nursing home, long-term care insurance will kick in. Many years ago, it was a very expensive product. And the benefits were not all that good. Lately, the insurance company has been a little bit more understanding, and so now they're offering these hybrid policies, which are in effect an insurance policy and a long-term care insurance, so that if you don't need the long-term care insurance, you're building up a cash reserve that will also be a benefit. But certainly. You know, so let's say you were going into a nursing home and you weren't able to qualify for MassHealth, the long-term care insurance might pay $180 a day towards the ultimate cash, the ultimate cost of the nursing home.
So what are the cost options and then strategies that we want to consider when we're looking at long-term care insurance?
Well, I mean, certainly if you can't afford long-term care insurance, and I think this is your question, I mean, what are some of the other ways that you might, you know, be able to pay for long-term care? We know it's a very expensive proposition. It's somewhere between $14,000 and $18,000 a month. And there's very little benefit out there. You know, there's a very, you know, popular misconception that Medicare has some impact on nursing home coverage, Medicare is not Medicaid, right? Medicare is not MassHealth here, which is what we call Medicaid in Massachusetts. So Medicare will not cover most long-term care costs. The exception is that if you are in a hospital and you have been in the hospital for 3 days and you are discharged from the hospital either directly to a nursing home or you go home, but it becomes evident that you need nursing home care within a 30-day period of your discharge from the hospital, Medicare will cover the first 20 days of your stay in a nursing home, and a copay you'd have of about $200 a day plus or minus in the nursing home for the next 80 days, and then you're on your own.
Yeah.
And you know, certainly spending down your assets is what we try to help people understand and plan for.
Yeah. So for those on limited income, you mentioned MassHealth. What should we know about eligibility for MassHealth and how you qualify?
Sure. So there are two aspects for MassHealth. And I'm only going to talk about nursing home coverage and situations. There are other MassHealth programs that people are able to get. There's a frail elderly program. These are other programs that MassHealth offers to allow people to stay in their homes if possible. But I'm going to only talk about institutional care, nursing home. And the rules are different if you're married or if you're single. Okay, so it becomes a bit of a complicated discussion, and that's kind of why I should have said at the beginning, and I'm going to say it now. You know, nothing we're talking about here is general information.
Yeah, general, right? Absolutely. Yeah.
And it's not intended to be any legal advice. So anything that that I say here should never lead someone to take any specific action without consulting an attorney.
To the rule, and your situation could be different, right?
Absolutely. Yep. And I meant to say that at the beginning, but anyway, so the rules are different, single person, married, but in general, once you have to start paying, you would have to, you got to kind of differentiate two factors. So you have to be medically eligible. So we'll assume someone's medically eligible. Now it's financially, okay? And you have to keep in mind the difference between income and resources. You know, and sometimes people conflate the two, but when we're talking about eligibility for MassHealth, it's an important distinction, because if someone has to go into a nursing home, their income goes to the nursing home, less what's called the personal need allowance. Resources are different. Resources is how much money you have in the bank, whether you own property, and there are exceptions to resources, countable resources for MassHealth purposes. So, but a single person, the resource limit is $2,000. The income, whatever their income is, Social Security, pension, would go to a nursing home, less $72.80, which is what we call the personal needs allowance. And here I'm going to put a plug in for contacting your state representative, because there are bills that are pending in the state legislature to increase that personal needs allowance all the way up to $113.42. So it's something that's very important. There's a push for it now because it has not changed in years with inflation. And that personal needs allowance is important because that allows someone to buy books, buy a gift for a grandchild, go out to a movie or whatever if they're capable of doing it.
$78 goes fast.
It certainly does. So all of your income less that personal needs allowance will go to the nursing home. If you have countable resources in excess of $2,000, then you're not able to get MassHealth. So we try to plan for the way someone might be able to get on MassHealth. What's not counted are your personal belongings, furniture in your home, an automobile. Pre-made burial arrangements, very important thing. We advise people all the time, whether they're doing MassHealth or even not, plan for your burial expenses. I mean, it's important for MassHealth purposes, but it's also important to someone who's not even going to be in that situation to take that burden off of a child or a sibling that's going to have to think about making those arrangements and paying for them and somehow getting compensated for.
Talk about the role of an executor and what we should know about the duties associated with that role.
Okay, so that leads to the discussion of what's probate, Mindy, and probate is a process that you need to go through. When you have property in your name when you pass away. And probate doesn't include like a joint bank account that you may own with someone. That's not going to go through probate. It goes automatically to that person. If you own a home with another person, with a spouse, that goes automatically. If you have a life insurance policy, there's beneficiaries. That's not what we're talking about. If you have an annuity, that's not what we're talking about. If you have an IRA, that's not what we're talking about. But we're talking about having assets in your own name, real estate, and no spouse or bank accounts or what have you. You have to go through probate to be able to appoint someone that can handle that. That's what we refer to generically as a personal representative, but that means an executor or possibly a, you know, a trustee. So the role of an executor would be to step in and administer the estate once someone passes away. If there's no will, then it's what we refer to as intestacy administration, and someone would be appointed to handle that that estate at that time. Or if you have a will, the will needs to be brought to the court and probated. Probate means probative, means you have to prove that it's a valid will, that it wasn't the product of undue influence or mistake of fact, or you were incompetent and they didn't really know what you were signing. But once you can establish that, then the will becomes admitted to probate and an executor is appointed. Where we sometimes advise people is to consider what's called a revocable trust, which has the consequence of avoiding probate. Because mm-hmm. if you can set up a revocable trust, then while you're alive, you basically control all of the assets in that trust. But if you become incapacitated or when you pass away, a successor trustee will step in and manage the estate. So
basically carry out your wishes.
That's right. Yeah. But in the if you're able to form a revocable trust, you wouldn't necessarily need to go through probate mm-hmm. if your assets have been put into the trust. Right. And what that does is it allows for a speedier and more efficient way of getting property out of the decedent's estate and into the hands of the beneficiaries. Because if you have to go through probate, there's a waiting period that you have to go through. There may or may not be court oversight or, as to the administration of it. So that's why we...
It could be a lengthy process.
It can be. And that's yeah. why we recommend people consider at least a revocable trust.
All right, so what are the different options for trusts? And talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So, people form trusts for a number of reasons. People may form them because they're concerned about a beneficiary's spendthrift, tendencies, and they may want to limit, someone getting money outright and blowing through it in 5 years. You may use a trust because you want to get some tax benefits. People sometimes use charities and set up trusts that will benefit charities when they pass away, but during their lifetime, they are helping the individual themselves. In our discussion, we're talking about, as a estate planning attorney, we're generally talking about a revocable trust that will assist someone in not having to go through probate when they pass away or when they become incapacitated. And then we talk about irrevocable trusts. Irrevocable trusts can be used for any number of purposes. I'm going to actually be doing a podcast with my firm later in the month, utilizing the Murdoch family as an example. As you may have seen in the newspapers and heard on the news, Mr. Murdoch, the patriarch, signed an irrevocable trust many years ago and basically gave all of his children, I think there are four of them, basically an equal say in what would happen when he dies. And he has become dissatisfied with the thoughts of at least three of those other children and wants to basically change his irrevocable trust to put all of the power or most of the power in one son who aligns more closely with his feelings and politics. And he's having trouble doing that because once you sign an irrevocable trust, it pretty much stays in place, and if there may be some minor amendments you can make and so forth. In our practice, or what we're talking about today, the irrevocable trust does assist in avoiding that spend down of your own assets if you do need mass health coverage, or if you do need it and don't want to have to spend all of your assets doing that.
It can be stressful or unpleasant for some people to think about putting their estate in order. It forces them to think about the end of life. If we have aging family members who may have been reticent to start this planning, how do you encourage these conversations and plans without making them feel like you're trying to control or consider them not long for this world?
Well, it's, you know, certainly a balance. You know, we go out and speak, you know, to groups. You know, I'm a member of the board of the neighborhood Falmouth here in Falmouth, and as you know, they do a great job in trying to keep people at home, you know, and able to provide services that enable that. You know, our goal is to just tell people you need to think about this. Because if you don't, you're going to burden your loved ones or children with this going forward. So it's important to plan. No one wants to go into a nursing home. No one expects to have to go into a nursing home. And we make that very clear to them that planning is actually going to help you accomplish what it is you want, which is not to have to go into a nursing home, or if it's absolutely necessary to go into a nursing home. Some or you know, a good portion of your assets may be able to be protected, you know, for your estate. Now, you know, there are philosophical discussions around whether, you know, it's a good idea to, you know, plan for Medicaid and, you know, let the government pay for you in a nursing home when you have, you know, have accumulated, you know, substantial assets over a period of time. All we can do is tell people what the options are, what the law permits, mm-hmm. and if they want to take advantage of that, we put them on that path to get to that place where they want to go.
Right. Let's talk to Dennis, who is giving us a call from Dennis. Hi, Dennis. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you so much for such a... Can you hear me okay?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you so much for such a comprehensive program today and for jumping right in. My question is, if you're an unmarried couple that lives separately but partners, can you make a combined trust for both parties? And also, if you could elaborate a little bit about the basic difference between a revocable trust and an irrevocable trust. Yeah. And thank you again for your thoroughness.
Sure, Dennis. I mean, certainly, as you know, as I said before, everybody's situation is different. And, you know, I'd certainly, if you intend to pursue this with your partner, you know, I suggest that you consult with an attorney on that specific issue. But in general, there would be nothing that would prevent you from entering into a trust situation with a partner, notwithstanding that you're unmarried. I've done it a number of times for clients. You know, there are certainly things that you have to consider before you go down that path. The basic difference between a revocable and an irrevocable trust is the revocable trust is really nothing more than just changing the title to certain assets. So instead of being, you know, in Dennis's name, they are in the Dennis Trust name. But generally, you are the trustee, you are the beneficiary of that trust. Setting up and very importantly, you can amend it, you can change it anytime, you can revoke it at any time. When we get into an irrevocable trust, you are still the grantor, but you are not more than likely going to be able to be the trustee, and you are may or may not be the beneficiary, because if you're the beneficiary of that irrevocable trust, you may lose the benefit of why you're doing an irrevocable trust. And as the name conveys, being irrevocable for the most part means you can't revoke it. Now, there are kind of back doors that allow you to basically terminate or change an irrevocable trust, but you need to go through a court proceeding possibly. You'd need the consent of all of the other beneficiaries. So that's the big question.
As you say, you want to consult somebody about your particular situation.
Right.
Dennis, thanks for the call. Bob Buscelli is an attorney in estate planning and elder law. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Important information. Thank you.
Coming up after break, Dr. Sarah Todd joins us to talk about death and dying and how to plan for a good death. You're listening to The Point. Dr. Sarah Todd is an emergency room physician and physician partner with Caring Pathways, offering families help during hospital stays and at the end of life. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Mindy.
So death is not something some people want to think about, much less talk about regularly. It makes many people uncomfortable. And because of that, it becomes taboo, right? But that's not always been the case. This is really kind of, you know, a newer trend, if you will. So what are some of the reasons our society is uncomfortable with death and dying?
I think in general, people are just uncomfortable about talking about death. But what's happened in society is death has been institutionalized. It's been taken out of the home. People used to die at home. People used to live in multi-generational households where you had children, you had parents, and grandparents would come and die in the home. So everyone saw what that was like. But now death happens out of the home. It happens in a nursing home. It happens in the hospital. It's been taken out of the home. So people just don't know what happens when people die.
All right. Death is a part of your line of work, but you've also experienced death in your personal life. How did those experiences influence your decision to help people through this final stage of life?
So my personal experience is my first husband, Evan, died of a brain tumor. He was diagnosed when our oldest children were 8 and 1. And he was also an emergency medicine physician. And we both knew from the time he was diagnosed that his brain tumor was not something that he would be able to survive or overcome. And he, from the time he was diagnosed to the time he died, it was over 7 years. So we spent a lot of time talking about all sorts of things, having very difficult discussions. And what happened for him was he had a death that he wanted. He died at home. He died in our house. I was there. Our oldest daughter was in the room with him and me when he died. Our younger two children were home with us. And he was able to be at home. He was able to have people around him that loved him. He was able to make choices so that he could enjoy what life he had left, even though he knew he was going to die. Yeah. And I don't see that happen very frequently at work. People come to the emergency department either in the process of dying or after they've died, and someone's called 911. And it's a very aggressive resuscitation. We do things called intubating people, which is where we put a breathing tube in, and CPR. What's shown on television, which is where most people get their ideas of how people die, is you die out of the hospital, someone calls 911, the ambulance comes, the paramedics resuscitate you, you come to the hospital, you have CPR, and within 2 days, you walk out the same person that you were. And that's not how it happens.
Yeah, not reality.
Not reality.
Yeah. So having conversations about death and dying, especially as we age, if we're diagnosed with life-ending illness, can have so many benefits. Talk about why these conversations, even if they're difficult, can be so meaningful and helpful.
So first of all, it helps the people around you know what you want, which is really, in my opinion, the best death someone can have is the death that they want. And you can't get the death that you want unless, A, you know what it is, and it takes some effort to think about that, and B, you've told the people around you what you want that death to look like. So talking about it gives you more control and more hope of getting the death that you want.
How do you initiate these conversations?
It can be hard. It can be hard outside of the hospital. It's a little bit easier for me inside the hospital. But, you know, I was just visiting my parents out of state and had these conversations with my mom, who never wants to talk to me about it. But I start by just saying, let's talk about what you'd want. let's make sure that we can make a plan so that what you want to have happen is what happens.
Yeah. And Bob had mentioned this earlier about, you know, kind of preparing for your own. My father had all of his, he had cancer, so he had time to do this, but he wrote his own obituary. He basically made all of the arrangements for, and thank goodness he did that, because there were things in his obituary that none of his children, we didn't know about him. So that would have just kind of, you know, not even been part of it. But that, I think that's such good advice. And I think I mentioned to you before on the air, my aunt and uncle who did not have children, they were in their 80s. I want to say mid 80s when I said, you know, I don't, what do you guys want when you die? I don't know. And they said, well, we've never talked about it. I'm like, you're in your 80s and you've never talked about it? It wasn't that they were reticent to do that. They did once I asked them that, but nobody'd ever asked them and they never thought to talk about it.
And I think, you know, it's expected that that's going to be a conversation people have with their primary care doctor or somewhere within the healthcare system. But with as many things as the primary care doctors need to get done now, they don't want to talk about it because it's uncomfortable for them. And the patients don't really want to talk about it. So it's hard to, even in that medical situation, that medical setting, start that conversation.
I think all of us hope to have a good death, as you say, and that can mean different things to different people. What are some of the things we should consider when we think about our death and we talk with a loved one about?
So there are all sorts of practical things about death. What do you want to have happen to your body when you die? Do you want to be cremated? Do you want to be buried? Is there a particular place you want to be buried? Do you want to do a home burial? What's available in your state? Another thing that I think is important as we talk about death and end of life with our family is talking about treatment. What treatment for an illness would you be willing to begin? Would you be willing to continue? And when would you cease that treatment in the course of an illness? Because those questions will really guide where you go.
Mm-hmm. You've been present at death at a number of times. Can you share an example of how planning for death made that transition more peaceful for the individual and their loved ones?
I'll go back to my own death, or my own death experience with my first husband. He was in hospice. He was actually in hospice for over 2 years, which, if you know anything about hospice,
that's a long time.
It's supposed to be 6 months, yeah. The last 6 months of life. But we were able to be at home. We were able to be with him. We were able to have people come and essentially say their last goodbyes to him while he was in the last weeks of his life. And that brought peace to so many of us that were there. When people die unexpectedly or die without having made a plan, 911 is typically called and the paramedics come. And without a MOLST form, they do everything. They start CPR, they do things, and they intubate or get an airway. And there's not a peaceful chance to hold somebody's hand, to sit with them, and to start grieving them as they leave.
I just want to say those hospice people are angels. Oh my gosh, and it's so helpful because they see death all the time. They can really help you understand the process, where we are at, and you know what to expect, and they're just wonderful.
I absolutely agree. You know, I think with death being moved out of people's houses and being institutionalized, hospice fills that void of what actually happens when people die. What stages do they go through, and they can help you see what's coming, which is really nice.
You mentioned the documents such as living wills, physician's orders for life-sustaining treatment, or healthcare proxies that can help in the process of creating a plan for treatment at end of life. Describe what these documents are and how they're used.
Sure. Healthcare proxies are a person, it's usually something that's created with an attorney, but it is a person who's appointed to make your healthcare decisions for you when you are no longer able to make them. There's a misconception that if you are someone's healthcare proxy, that you get to know everything about what's going on and you get to make their decisions. But the healthcare proxy actually has to be invoked, meaning that the patient or the person is no longer able to make their own decisions. And then the healthcare proxy makes their decisions for them. In my opinion and feeling, a lot of people are made healthcare proxies without the conversation mm-hmm. about what the patient wants, what they want at the end of life, what they're willing to live with, and treatment they're willing to go through, and treatment that they absolutely don't want to have. So that puts a lot of burden on the person who is the healthcare proxy to make these decisions not having had the conversation. The best thing you can do when you have a healthcare proxy is talk to them and tell them what you want. And my recommendation is it happen every year. The same way you're supposed to change the batteries in your smoke detectors, pick a day, and every year on that day, you have a conversation with your healthcare proxy and talk to them about what you want and what you don't want, because it can change over time.
I was going to say, yeah, your health changes, your mind changes. Yeah, exactly. We're talking about end-of-life planning. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Dr. Sarah Todd, an emergency room physician and physician partner with Caring Pathways, offering families help during hospital stays and at the end of life. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We have an email from Carol relating back to our first segment. She says, I have long-term care insurance and have since my 50s. I'm now 80. I've had claims for care for various issues, including orthopedic replacements. I've had to hire an insurance claim negotiator to resolve these claims, which originated 4 years ago, still unresolved despite extensive documentation. My point is long care insurance claims can literally take years to resolve. Carol, thanks for sharing that. Before the break, Dr. Todd, we were talking about living wills, physician's orders, and life-sustaining treatment with healthcare proxies. So you got into the healthcare proxies. What about the others?
So what you mentioned a pulsed form. Currently in Massachusetts, we're using a MOLST form, which is they're pretty much the same thing, and we're transitioning to the pulsed form. MOLST is Massachusetts orders for life-sustaining treatment, and pulsed is physician orders for life-sustaining treatment, sometimes called portable orders. What those are is think of them as a prescription for what you want to have in your last moments of life, in your last perhaps months of life. It specifically addresses intubation. It addresses CPR. It addresses what we call non-invasive ventilation, which is something like CPAP. If people are familiar with CPAP, when people have sleep apnea and they wear it at night to help them breathe.
Is that like a respirator?
Well, it's not really a respirator. It's just a mask that people put on their face, and it helps keep their airways open, and it helps with pressure when they breathe. But they can wake up and take it off at any moment.
Yeah.
So those things are addressed, as well as IV hydration, transport to the hospital, feeding tubes, and dialysis. Those are all specific issues that are addressed on these MOLST or pulsed forms. And what happens when somebody has one of those forms is typically when people die, the first call is to 911 because people are scared and they don't know what to do, especially, I mean, even if it's an expected death, that's oftentimes the first phone call. And when the ambulance comes, they need to start full resuscitation. If they have one of these forms are filled out and they're signed, by a physician or a nurse practitioner or a PA. And if 911 comes, the ambulance comes after someone's died and you hand them one of these forms, they can follow that form. It's like a physician order. It's me saying, don't do this, but do these two things. And the paramedics aren't allowed to make those decisions when they get to the scene, but with this form, they can follow what the patient, what the
And how do we make sure that medical teams, especially in an emergency, have access to this documentation?
So here on Cape Cod, we're in a unique position because we have one healthcare system that runs both of the hospitals on the Cape. So when you have one of these forms, you can take it to the hospital and they can put it in your medical record. Most people, when they get these forms, if they're towards the end of life, they keep them with them. They put them in a glove compartment in a car. If there's a caretaker, the caretaker has it. Most people put them on the refrigerator.
I was going to say, on the refrigerator. Yep. We did. My uncle was on the refrigerator. You see it when you walk in.
This mold form is hot pink. It's hard to miss. It's bright pink, which helps me find it quickly in a stack of papers. But that refrigerator, and a lot of times in nursing homes or assisted living facilities, they're taped on the back of the resident's door.
Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, if you're entering hospice, they're going to walk you through all this. But if you're not, you know, how do you even know about them? I mean, how do you go about getting these forms and having these conversations?
So this is always something that you can do with your primary care doctor.
Oh.
I see people outside of the hospital and fill out these forms and have discussions at a more leisurely pace. The primary care doctors are so busy mm-hmm. that this is just another thing that needs to be done. But I certainly meet with people outside of the hospital.
Right. So what are your thoughts on medical decisions at end-of-life care for people with dementia? They may have made their end-of-life plans before dementia set in, or maybe they didn't make those plans, and now loved ones must make those decisions for them. So how do you talk with patients and families in this situation?
What I focus on in this situation is I focus on the joy-to-pain ratio. I think what joy people find in their daily lives can change at different points in time. I mean, think about the joy that you had when you were 20 versus the joy mm-hmm. when you're 50. And I expect to have different joys when I'm 80. And when there is more joy in somebody's day than there is pain, I think that it is reasonable to keep going. When the pain outweighs the joy, then I think it's time to talk about not being aggressive in medical resuscitation. Mm-hmm. And joys can be simple. Joys can be, I remember as my husband was dying, we had caretakers in the house that helped care for him for a few hours. And one of them was just the most lovely human. And every evening she massaged his feet and put moisturizer on him. And my mom and I looked at that and we said, that's what we want. We want someone to do that when we're getting towards the end. Yeah. So the joy can be simple.
Yeah.
It doesn't need to be big, but when the joy is greater than the pain, I think it makes sense to keep going. But when that ratio tips and the pain is what takes up most of your day, I think it's time to back off.
And I guess, if you have somebody who has some form of dementia and there aren't family members around, what do you do in that situation?
Well, that's hard. That's when frequently the legal team gets mm-hmm. involved, and people are oftentimes appointed guardians, court-appointed guardians, who, in my experience, don't know the patient and are very hard to get a hold of mm-hmm. after 5 o'clock,
mm-hmm.
and certainly not on the weekends. And so many times in that situation, the MOLST form is filled out, and you can fill out a MOLST form and it says do everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I follow those and feel as though I'm inflicting a lot of suffering on people when it's a guardianship and they don't know the patient.
We know that a lot of medical intervention can happen in the last stages of life. And some people say they'd like all the medical interventions unless they're at the end of life. Are directives like that clear enough for family and medical professionals? Will they know when someone is? I mean, you will, but will family know when someone's at the end of life?
I think this is one of the areas where it shows up how uncomfortable physicians are about talking about death and facing death. We know the general public doesn't like to talk about it, but even as physicians, you know, we've been raised in this society of medicine where death is the enemy mm-hmm. and we don't want to let people die and we have to keep going. When there's more of a movement now where we understand people are going to die and we want people to be comfortable and we want people to have choices. So if that's the wish of the person, the patient, we want everything done until it becomes futile. The family or the people that are around really need to ask that pointed question. What's it going to be like on the other side of this? If you put the breathing tube down, into my lungs, am I ever going to come off of it? If you do CPR and I wake up, what's it going to feel like? When we do CPR, it's just the process of the intervention. Ribs break, the sternum breaks. So when someone has CPR, 98% of the time, they also have the breathing tube. And once the breathing tube goes down and CPR happens, if the patient regains pulses and is quote unquote alive, they're put on a ventilator. So that means mechanically air is being forced into your lungs, your chest is expanding, and then it goes down, the air goes out of your lungs. So with broken ribs that we have caused, this is the sensation that somebody's going to have. We do use pain medicine. We do try to make people comfortable, but that's a really uncomfortable experience to wake up in.
Right. Physicians are trained to sustain life, right? How much training do doctors get to assist patients and families when patients are at the end of life? And could we improve that training?
Absolutely, we could improve that. There's more in medical education today than there has been in probably the past 20 years. With palliative care as a specialty, there are more people out there that are trained in doing it. Some of the medical schools address it better than others, but it's still uncomfortable for most physicians to talk about death, and they don't want to take hope away from patients and their families.
What kinds of services are available to families and caregivers as they navigate hospital stays and end of life?
So my company, Caregiving Pathways, is available to help the caregivers understand what's coming. There are also other organizations within Massachusetts, the Massachusetts Coalition for Serious Illness, which helps people more specifically with end of life things. There are programs like Five Wishes or the Conversation Project, with which help people talk about what they want to do and their last days and how.
One of those things with conversations, sometimes, you know, you have a parent and the parents are reluctant to talk to the kids, but they might be more open to talking to a family friend, a physician, the lawyer, the clergy, something like that, right? So I guess it would be, if you're in that situation, what's your advice for, you know, children who can't seem to get their parents to talk to them?
I think that the conversation can be started with anyone. Like you said, an attorney is a great place to start the conversation. Clergy is a wonderful place. If there's a family friend, a lot of times what starts the conversation is watching somebody else's death and saying, oh, I liked how this happened for them, but I don't want that to happen for me. And that is a great place to start. Starting the conversation with anyone is the right way to do it. Once you have it there, you need to really let family, any caretakers, and anybody else who is involved with you know what you want.
Mm-hmm. It's so important, too, to let them know what you want, because I'm sure you've seen this, where somebody goes into a coma and, you know, one child says, well, no, mom wanted this. No, I'm sure she wanted this. And then there's those arguments among the family members on what mom wanted.
And that's why if you fill out a MOLST form or a POLST form, it's right there. Yeah. This is what I want.
Yeah. As we plan for our own death or help someone else make their plan, what are some of the key directives that we should have in place?
So my recommendations are to plan and prepare so that you don't have to react and regret. I mean, that's the biggest thing, I think, is make a plan. Some of the things that we need to do as we're thinking about our own death is, what do we want? What do we want in the last minutes of our life, the last hours of our life, the last days of our life? Where do we want to be dying? Who do we want to have with us while we're dying? We can make a plan for a vigil or who we want and how we want those last days to go, and then talk with people about it.
Something to really think about, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Dr. Sarah Todd's an emergency room physician and physician partner with Caring Pathways, offering families help during hospital stays and at the end of life. We'll post a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.